things I want to talk about. Well, first I'm going to start with some motivation, but then after that I will talk about Solomon's theory. In the 1/n expansion, what is called the 1/n expansion. So I will try to explain this physics concept in also mathematical way. Now, after that, I will give a very short introduction to gamma with invariants, just essentially reminding what they are, and then multi-covering properties, what are called multi-covering formulae, okay, and what are called DPS invariants here. So I'm not going to get deeply into this because I think Jean and Melissa are going to cover that for me. So, and then I will actually talk about the relation between multi-invariants and enumerative geometry. Then I will talk about extension. So these are not invariants for nodes in S3. And I will talk about extension to other three manifolds if I have the time. And also if I have the time, which I don't know, I will tell you about Gramov-Witten theory of Calabi-Yau threefolds. Actually, I have to be more specific here. Toric Calabi-Yau threefolds and Solomon's theory. So essentially after this introduction, I will tell you about what are the implications if you want of enumerative geometry for knot invariants. Then I will go the other way around. I will tell you mostly what are the implications of Solomon's theory for complete gamma-with invariants. These are really different things, and both of them are important, but I want to focus first on this. So if I have time, I will cover the other thing. So let me start with some motivation from the physics. The title of this workshop is the interaction between finite type invariants and Gramov-Witten invariants. So finite type invariants, the way at least I understand it, is as invariants coming from Solomon's theory, which is a gauge theory. Okay, so you have on one side a gauge theory. On the other hand, you have Gramov-Witten invariants, which in physics come naturally from string theory. So the fact that there is a relationship between these two invariants comes from the fact that there should be a relation between gauge theory and string theory. Okay? Now, what's the idea behind that? Okay, the idea was actually proposed by Toft already in the 70s. So what he proposed is that if you take a UI gauge theory, there is a way of writing that, which is called the 1/n expansion. In which you seem to be producing, in which the computations that you do in this gauge theory look like computations in a string theory. So I will be much more precise about this in what follows. But this is essentially the main idea. So this is, of course, something that you don't know if you can take it seriously, right? But this idea has been a very very constant idea in all the developments that came after Toft introduced this. So this is a conjectural correspondence, the correspondence between gauge theory and gauge theory, and we don't even know if this holds for any gauge theory. For example, for any gauge theory that you can come with, you can actually produce a string theory that describes this gauge theory. Okay, you can call this a duality between gauge theory and string theory. Now, is there any evidence for that? Well, the reason why we still play around with this idea is that because we have actually some positive evidence for that. So, and what is interesting, all the cases which have been considering, which is this duality, almost all the cases in which this duality holds, actually have some nice mathematical implications. So let me give you the first example of this duality. Let's consider topological gravity in two dimensions. Okay, you can regard this as the simplest string theory of all, a string theory which has as a target a point. Okay? String theory here is going to be a theory of maximum Riemann surface total. You have to specify what kind of string theory you are working with. But in this case, you have a very simple model in which you are essentially describing intersection theory on the model space of Riemann surface. Well, we know that this, as a string theory, has a description in terms of a gauge theory, which is the matrix model of Concevich. So you can regard this as a string theory size, and you can regard this as a gauge theory size, because a matrix model is just a gauge theory in 0+0 dimensions. Now, there is a small extension of this, which corresponds to taking what are called topological strings in dimension less than one. Okay. So again, you can think about these theories as strings with a discrete target space, and again you have a matrix model a la Concevich describing this model. So here this is a very simple case in which you have a correspondence between a string theory and a gauge theory with very well-known mathematical implications. Now there is another case which is interesting, which is Jamin's theory in two dimensions. Okay, Jamin's theory in two dimensions formulated on the Riemann surface of genus GSA sigma G is actually an exactly solvable model. You can compute, for example, you can compute a partition function here. It has this beautiful formula. Something like that, where this is the dimension. This is a sum over all possible irreducible representations of UN. Okay, again, I'm taking the UN theory. This is the quadratic casing of the representation, and you have an expression like that. Okay, it's known. Sorry?
Is that a quantum dimension on R?
No, this is a classical dimension. Okay, this is just classical dimension. And this is the usual quadratic casing. So it's known that this theory can be interpreted as a theory of covariance from a Riemann surface sigma 8 to the original target of the theory sigma g. Okay, so the string theory description of this gauge theory involves Hurwitz numbers. Okay, essentially, you get just a theory of covariance of this Riemann surface where the Jamin's theory lives by another Riemann surface sigma h. Okay, this is an also interesting example involving Hurwitz numbers, and if you want through the ALSB formula to Gromov with the invariance again. And there is a final case, which is, if you want, the most studied case from the physical point of view, which is slightly more complicated and with maybe less obvious physical implications, which is the Moldavsena correspondence. Okay, so here what you have in the gauge theory is n equal 4 super Jamin's theory, so a gauge theory with 4 supersymmetries. Don't worry if you don't know the details of this, because I'm not going to deal with this. I just want to mention that this exists. And this is equivalent to a certain string theory, which is tied to B theory. So this is a gauge theory in R or R13 in Minkowski space. And the corresponding gauge theory, string theory dual, is a theory in ADS5, and S5. So this is a 10-dimensional string theory with a quite funny target space in which you have an empty super space in 5 dimensions, plus a sphere in 5 dimensions. Okay. So, well, this is an example I'm not going to deal with. Also, this example, I have to mention, that shows something very important from the point of view of this correspondence. When you think about this correspondence, you know that the gauge theory lives in some space, let's call it M. Okay. So a string theory is a theory of maps from a Riemann surface to a given target. And people assume for a long time that the target of a string theory should be the same space-time where the gauge theory was defined. Okay? But this example in particular shows you in a very dramatic way that this is not the case, because the gauge theory is defined on R13 and the string theory lives in a completely different space. Okay? So this is one lesson that I think is important from the Moldavsena conjecture, which is that the target of the string theory is not a priori related to the space-time of the gauge theory. Okay? Okay, with that, I think I will stop with my general considerations. But what we are going to describe in this case, okay, is another example of this, which is Chern-Simons, UN Chern-Simons theory in history. Well, that I will make that precise. But what you will see is, for example, the free energy of one model defined in terms of this theory is the free energy, say, of, and I will make that very precise in what follows. Okay, but essentially, you can say that everything you can compute on one side, you can compute it also the other side. Okay. So what I'm going to describe is a correspondence between you and Sir Simon's theory on the three sphere to begin with, as equivalent to what is called a topological string theory. So topological string theory is just a way of getting Gromov-Witten invariance in physics. Topological string theory on a Calabi-Yau manifold, which is the resolved manifold. So you can see the resolved manifold in many ways, and one of them is as this bundle over P1. Okay, so this is a six-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold. So you have four non-compact directions, two compact directions, P1. And here you see the same phenomenon going on. I mean, the true Simon string is defined on S3, but the target of the string theory is this non-compact Calabi-Yau manifold. So this is going to be a theory of maps from the Riemann surface to this manifold. And you see this is going to be describing the dynamics of a Gauss geometry. Okay? So this is a general principle that when you are dealing with strings, you don't have to find the same target as you have in the Gauss theory. Okay? Okay, good. So now let me start with this particular thing. Let me start talking about Sir Simon's theory. Okay? So many of the things I'm going to say are going to be better said by Dror probably today in the Senate or tomorrow if they change the because he will explain in detail the perturbative approach to Sir Simon's theory. So I will be a little bit quick here. Okay. So I will probably insist more on the physical side. So let me. So what is Sir Simon's theory? Okay, let me write the Sir Simon's axiom first. So what you do in order to construct this Sir Simon's theory is you take any three manifold n, you take the trivial un bundle over it, and you consider a gauge connection A on this bundle over A over M, and then you consider a theory described classically by a Lagrangian or by an axiom, and you take the axiom to be this one. Okay? So the idea that you can study this axiom as a dynamical axiom for a gauge connection was introduced by Witten in 1989, and the main characteristic he showed in this axiom is that in order to define it, you don't need to use the metric of the three manifold. The only thing you have to use is the wedge operator and the V operator. So you only need to use the differential structure of M. So you don't have to really talk about the metric. Sorry? Okay. This is G string. Okay. but right now it's just a name. Okay. This is what you would call the coupling constant of the theory. Okay. So you have something that is the prefactor of the action, and this appears in the Feynman perturbation expansion is what you would call the coupling constant. Okay, but right now it's just a constant in front of the action. Okay. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Please. Okay. Now, so this action is topological because it doesn't depend on the metric. And you can see that, well, you can say, okay, but this is just a classical symmetry reaction, what happens in the quantum theory, and it's also when you quantize the theory, you have to be more careful. There are some framing effects that you have to take into account, but at the end of the day, if you do everything properly, you get a theory which is topological. So what does it mean it's topological? Well, it means that you can now define the partition function of this Gauss theory, which is going to depend on GS, on the rank of the Gauss group, and this is what you would call formally equal to a path integral of this action. Okay? Of course, this doesn't have a lot of sense, but there are good definitions of this quantity, for example, due to Reshevsky and Turev, and I guess that Professor Benzel is going to talk about that later on, about how to construct rigorously these quantities. Okay? So this is a quantity that you can define physically. It's called the partition function of the theory, depends on GS and N, and turns out that it's a topological invariant of the manifold M, okay? Provided you choose a framing of the manifold N. So in what follows, I will always work in the canonical framing in order to avoid the difficulties. Okay? Now, there is another quantity that you can compute here, and it's the following. Well, in order to define the partition function, we don't have to use any metric. Now, in quantum field theory, you can also compute what are called vacuum expectation values of operators. So, If you want to preserve this topological invariance, you have to be very careful in choosing operators that don't introduce a metric dependence. And these are called Wilson loops. So what you do is you take the holonomy. So you are in S3, you take a knot in S3. You take the holonomy of this connection around this knot. And you take the trace of this holonomy in the representation of R. Okay, so this is an operator. This is an holonomy. You haven't used the method to define it. And this defines what is called a Wilson loop operator. Okay? Now, you can now compute what is called the vacuum expectation value of this operator. So let me call it WR kappa. So R is an irreducible representation again of UN. Sorry? Yeah, you can take any representation, okay? But I will actually deal only with reducible ones. So you can now compute this, okay? And this is in physics again, and I put here some quotation marks. This is a path integral in which you take an average of this operator with the weight given by the action and you normalize it. So this is what you would call, after you define this properly, the quantum group invariant of the knot kappa in the representation R for a Gaines group UN, or UN the UN quantum group invariant of this knot. Okay. Now again, there is a framing story here, in the sense that when you, from the point of view of physics, what happens is, again, this is not strictly a topological invariant of the knot, but it's a topological invariant of the frame knot. So there is a story here which is going to be relevant later, which is what is called the choice of the framing of the knot, okay? Now, if you have a knot in S3, you have a canonical framing for the knot, but you can change the framing from the canonical framing to any framing labeled by an integer p in Z, and the way this vacuum expectation value changes is well known. So the way it changes is by a phase, which is q p c r over 2 w r. Okay, where Q is actually e to the I ds, and this is, if you want to relate this to typical candidate in terms of muscle, this is what you would call K plus N. Okay, so here my ds string is going to be what people in quantum group in my theory call K plus N, so the level plus the rank of the base group, okay? So this is the typical variable that enters into all these computations, and this describes the change of framing. So also the knot has to be framed. You can control the change of framing by this very simple operation. And this is again going to be relevant in what follows. CR again is the quadratic Casimir of the representation. And well, just to give some details that I will later on. So I will actually, this irreducible representation of UN, I will label them by Jontov laws in the usual way. Okay, so it's saying that you have the L1, L2, up to LK are the lengths of the different rows of this Jontov law. Okay, so the total number of boxes is the sum of I, and I will denote it by L or L of R. So this is going to be the total number of the representation. And in terms of these quantities, you can write CR as L times N plus something that I will call many times kappa R, and kappa R is L plus, L plus so these are just more explicit formulae for these quantities in the case of UA, okay? Now, so in what follows, unless I say the contrary, I will take the canonical framing of the knots in history. Okay. Now, everything I say here for knots extends to links. Okay. So now you can consider, instead of a single knot, you can consider the links of its forms. Say, for example, the Hovnin, okay, with plus or minus one crossing. And then you can now define an object. So what you have to do now is, here we put a representation in this related to this knot K, okay? Now, since you have many components in the link, you have to put representations in each of the components. So you have a link of L components, say, you will have to put representations R1 up to RL in each of the components of the link. And you can still compute the expectation value of the product of a Wilson loop operators, where L is made out of ki components, where I was from 1 to L. Okay, so you have a link made out of L components. Each of them is a knot, kappa I. And then you can construct the same operator here, take the product, and take again the value expectation value. Okay? And this is what is called the quantum loop invariant of the link L in the representations R1 up to RL. Okay? So let me make a couple of comments about normalizations. Here, Q, no. No, well, GS appeared, right? GS is, yeah, the GS is the coupling constant to Simon's theory. So this is just meaning that, I mean, when you do this computation, you can do it in the physical theory, and this depends on the coupling constant of the theory, okay? So GS is what, in writing the Simon's action, I wrote it like this.
Normally, you put something like a K,
right, and there is a... Yeah, this is a big debate. Maybe Dror has a more detailed account than I. But yeah, sometimes people say, okay, here you have K. Okay, so you write this as K over 4 pi. So this is an advanced topic. K over 4 pi, and K is the K is the coupling constant of Simon's theory. And then you say that this is the level of the Western Newton model related to the Simon's theory. And then you say that there is a shift, a one loop for normalization effect or whatever, and then you have this shift k going from k plus n, blah, blah, blah. Other people say, no, you're completely misled, okay? You have here cap k of Chern Simons, and k of Chern Simons is k plus n, where k is the level of the subminority, okay? So in order to avoid entering into this discussion, I will actually call Gs essentially 2 pi I over k plus n. And the only thing you have to know is that when you in the final results in the series of the quantum invariants, the variable that appears is e to the I gs, where gs is related to the level of the Western Newton model in this way. Okay, I don't want to enter into the question of what if this guy is k or k plus n or whatever. Okay, so this there was a big debate, at least in the physics literature in the 90s, over this. And I don't know what is the status of this, if it was resolved or not. So, but we don't really have to deal into that. Okay. So I will call Gs this quantity here, and this is the quantity that appears naturally in the definition of the quantum loop invariants. Okay. So let me just make two comments about normalizations. Okay. So my normalizations are going to be as follows. In S3, I will take the partition function of S3 to be the S matrix of the Western Newton model at level K. Okay? So sometimes people take the partition function of S3 to be 1. Okay? This is not the natural physical normalization. The physical normalization is this, and this is the one I'm going to take. My normalization for knots is that if you take the trivial knot, the un knot, the quantum of the invariant of the un knot is the quantum dimension of R, okay? So let me write it this way. Okay, so for example, for the fundamental representation, which is your one box, you will have lambda to 1/2. The quantum loop invariant of the knot in this representation is given by this formula, okay, where lambda is Q to the n, or if you want e to the ds times n, and choose the variable that I introduced before. Okay? So you can see that when, this is called the quantum dimension of representation R, and there are explicit formula for this. I can write them for you if you want. For the fundamental representation, just this simple expression, and it has the property that when ds string goes to zero, what you get here, the coefficient that you get of the first term is actually the classical dimension of R. Okay? So this is something that, if you interpret this as a series in the string, the first term is going to be given by the classical dimension of the representation, the usual dimension of the representation, and then you have corrections that go like powers of ds. Okay? So many times I will call ds the string, okay? So don't worry about that for the moment being. This is, I have already interiorized the idea that this is the string coupling constant, and it will be a string coupling constant. So yeah, if I say the string, the string, yeah, I mean this DS, okay? Okay, so this more or less sets the story a little bit. Well, I guess that in the talks about how to construct this invariant way, we will be able to, there will be other talks with more precise definitions of this quantum group invariant. This is just here recording some facts. So now, let me try to start introducing the 1 over n expansion, okay? So here we have some quantities. We have defined this partition function. We have mentioned that there is this partition function. We have mentioned there are these quantum group invariants. I want to understand this from the point of view of this 1 over n expansion, okay? So the thing that you want to first to compute in the 1 over n expansion is what is called the free energy of the theory, okay? So the free energy of the theory is just the logarithm of this partition function, okay? So in the case of S3, you have here this entry of the Western Minimum S matrix. I will come back to this in more detail, okay? And you just take the log as a function of n and ds, okay? Now, this quantity has actually a very beautiful interpretation from the point of view of perturbation theory. So if you take Trans-Angular theorem S3, here there is only one connection with S3, one flat connection, which is a trivial one. So essentially here, instead of talking about Trans-Angular theorem S3, you can talk about, for example, the LMO invariant of S3. Or the R-Hus integral of S3. So you can construct an invariant mathematically, well-defined mathematically, which only captures the contribution of the trivial connection to S3, to the S3. Since in the case of, in this case, the LMO invariant captures all the complex Trans-Angular theorem S3, and it's known that if you have the LMO invariant of S3 or the R-Hus integral of S3, you can write it, you can write this theory in a very nice way. So let me probably draw, we'll talk in more detail about that. So you can write it as follows. I don't know if this is the standard notation, but so let me explain what I'm doing like this here. Okay. So what you do from the point of view of physics is you do a perturbative computation of this partition function of Trans-Angular theorem. Okay. So when you do perturbation theory of Trans-Angulars, the first thing you have to notice is that the only interaction you have is this cubic interaction. Okay. So the diagrams that you will get for computing this quantity are going to be trivalent graphs. Okay. So in computing F, the free energy, it turns out, and I guess that Dror will explain this in more detail, in computing F, the only thing you have to compute are contributions coming from connected vacuum bubbles, so from trivalent graphs of this form, okay? So with no external legs, okay? So you will have a set of trivalent graphs constructed in this way. There are some ways that they have to satisfy, and actually the space where this where these graphs live. It's a highly dimensional space that sometimes people write in this way. So you take the connected trivalent graphs of degree n, where n is the number of vertices here, and this is a finite dimensional space. Of dimension Ln. Okay. So for example, this is 1/2 the number of vertices. So for example, n equal 1, the dimension is 1, and this space is spanned by a single graph. If n is equal to 2, Ln is again equal to 1, and this space is spanned by a single graph, and so on and so forth. So these are just the diagrams that you get in quantum field theory by doing the standard techniques of Feynman perturbation theory. Okay, now you can formalize this in this very nice way by introducing this space of connected trivalent graphs, modulus and relationships. I guess that Roy will explain that in much more detail. And you get this structure here. Okay. Well, the alternative to this is to explain Feynman perturbation theory in physics terms. I guess this is still better. Okay. So you have this space like that.
Justin
Salwan
will explain all of that in great detail, and I will only reiterate.
Who? Justin Salwan. Okay. Yeah, these are actually the graphs the choice of basis of his thesis. Now, so this is a sum in principle over, you take all possible graphs when you sum over the number of vertices. Okay. So you take all possible number of vertices, all possible, which are always even. In this case, that is very easy to see. So you sum over all possible values of n. For each n, you have to go through all possible independent trivalent graphs that you have here. So this is this second sum here. Now you will have, so this sum is going to have a coefficient, which is this fnin that I wrote here. And you will have for each n, you will have the power of s to the n, okay?
Fnin is the Feynman, is the f stand for Feynman somehow?
Yeah, this is the, if you want, well, no, for the free energy. No, this f is the coefficient. This is what you would call, you know, the finite type invariant of this manifold of order n and for im, okay? And then, given each of these graphs, in order to recover the value of the Chern-Simons theory with case group un, what you do is to apply a weight system. Okay, so here what you do is you take any graph of this, you apply the weight system of un, and then you will get here polynomials even. Okay. So for example, the weight system acting on here is going to give you n times n squared minus 1. Here you will get 4 n squared minus 1, and so on. So this quantity is actually a quantity which depends on years through the number of vertices you have in the trivalent graphs, and it depends on n in this very very detailed way, which is applying the weight system of un to these graphs here. So from the point of view of physics, what we are doing is, okay, we have this quantum field theory, which is a quantum field with only a vertex, which is cubic. Its vertex has a power of es as a degree, and we do a perturbative expansion in the evaluation of this quantity. And since we are doing quantum field theory, every time that we see a graph like this, we have to compute what is called its group factor, and this is what mathematicians call applying the weight system to this graph, okay? So this is then a function of n and ds. Okay. And this is the free energy of the theory. So this is the usual perturbative approach to the theory. And you see that you can regard this as a power series in ds, and at every order in ds you will have here a polynomial in n. Okay. Now what I'm going to talk tomorrow is a way to reorganize this power series in powers of n, both n and ds. In order to do that, I will have to change what are my trivalent graphs. I will have to introduce a more refined graph, which is the top graph or the fat graph, and this will give rise to the one-order expansion. Okay? So I will stop here for the moment.